up. It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. It's day 5 of the NBA bubble. That's right. I can actually count days of games instead of days of limbo now. Basketball's back. It's different. It's a little strange. The fans look a little weird. But overall, not bad. So far, so good. Here to help me break it all down today, the former coach of the Pistons and Magic. Currently, of course, a color commentator for TNT and the NBA's newest Twitter star, Stan Van Gundy. Stan, how are you?
I'm good, Howard. How are you?
I'm great. I don't know which to ask you first, your bubble experience so far or your Twitter experience. Which one is stranger?
Look, the bubble experience for the media, you know, the broadcasters is not like what the players are going through. You know, it's just not as restrictive. I mean, yeah, we only go to the hotel and over to the broadcast, but quite honestly, like, there's no security around or anything. I mean, it's more of an honor system type of thing. And in fact, even in what they've given us in writing, they're letting people go to Disney Springs, and entertainment and restaurants and things like that place. That's open to the public. So they're not really as worried about what's going on with us. So other than being away for just a long period of time, and the strangest thing for me is I live 45 minutes from here, and I'm going to be gone 7 weeks. So other than that, that one's not too different. Twitter's been a whole different experience here for a month because I've avoided social media my entire life. But because of politics and wanting to have some say and try to influence some people and some things going into the election this year, I got on it, and it's been a little bit different, but I'm always speaking out, so it's just a matter of a different medium, and sure. I do a little, instead of sending emails and texts to people I know, I type in stuff for a lot of people that I might not know personally, so really not a whole lot of difference.
Fair. Good assessment. From what I've read so far, you're staying out of your mentions and not looking at the responses. So that's probably the healthy thing to do. I, on the other hand, spent half of today in a Twitter war with Nickelback. So I don't know how that happened exactly. I know how it happened. I made a bad joke about Nickelback and they got mad about it. So now I'm in a Twitter war with Nickelback. This is welcome to 2020, where I've spent half of a day fighting with the bad Canadian rock band on Twitter.
There you go.
I don't recommend my Twitter strategy, Stan, is I guess what I'm saying.
I've stayed away from that early on. People recommended it to me and I've done that. Like, I'm not going to get in a Twitter war. I'll post what I want. I do a lot of, like everybody, a lot of retweets and stuff like that of some really smart people on Twitter and things, but I'm not going to get in a war with people and go back and forth. Everybody's entitled to their own point of view, and I'm not going to let them win by trying to get under my skin, I guess.
Fair. Of course, you're already steeled for this kind of thing, unlike me, right? Like, you spend all your time having people heckling you in the arena, screaming things at you, going in and out of hotels, whatever. Like, it's a different for me. Like, I get on Twitter, get screamed at. Like, I'm actually a little like, oh, damn, I pissed somebody off. Like, that's for NBA coaches. That's just the norm. So. Anyway, I do want to get back to the Twitter thing later. I'm sorry, you had something you want to say?
No.
Okay. I want to get back to the Twitter thing because I love what you're doing with it, and I wanted to touch on that. But let's talk basketball first, though. It's August 3rd, which is a weird time for us to even be talking about live NBA games. We are, as I said, 5 days in as I tape this on Monday afternoon, so obviously there's games going on right now. But what strikes you so far? Because the one thing I thought going into this was, all right, 4.5 months off, guys couldn't play. A lot of guys didn't even have baskets available to them. Chemistry and momentum and all these things, teams being in sync, all those things we normally talk about in the spring are just out the window. And so I wasn't sure what to expect. And you had the very first game last Thursday, Pelicans Jazz. What have you seen so far that strikes you about whether it's the quality of play, whether certain teams look like they might be ahead of others? What has leapt out?
Well, what stood out to me is, number one, I think the players are excited to be playing again. Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that, even with no fans or anything else. I mean, I think they're happy to be out there playing basketball after 4.5 months. What we've seen in the games is a lot of scoring. I mean, scoring is way up, a lot of points, a lot of threes, and good three-point shooting, and a lot of fouls, a lot of guys going to the free throw line. We have not seen, other than a couple of teams, a great deal of defense. I think a couple of teams have gotten after it pretty good defensively, but I think what's happening is a couple of things. I think, number one, these guys still aren't in midseason form conditioning-wise, and defense has a lot to do with conditioning. And so I don't think guys are ready to be down in a stance for long periods of time and moving their feet, and they're not ready. And then also I think is, you know, they had a three-week training camp, but not like we normally have in training camp. I mean, normally you start training camp, and guys have had the whole summer, and they've been working out, and they've been playing, and they're getting in shape, and they're ready to go to training camp. And so when you hit that first day of training camp, you can push them pretty hard. And I think a lot of people, you know, at least the defensively oriented teams, really push the defense in training camp, do a lot of drill work and everything else. I think this training camp's been different, and guys, I don't think we're ready to be pushed that hard in training camp. And so I think these camps tended to be more of get in your offense, get organized, start bringing guys along and getting them in shape, get up and down the court. But that hard, you know, intense defensive work, I don't think guys were ready for, and so coaches couldn't do, and we're seeing it in the course of the games. As I said, I think when guys get in better shape, when the games start to mean more, then I think we'll see the defense buckle down. But what we're seeing right now is huge numbers from people. But I think the games have been fun to watch. We've had the vast majority of them have been competitive right down to the wire. You couldn't ask for a whole lot more after the 4.5 month layoff.
Yeah. I was saying coming into this semi-facetiously, but semi-seriously, that the seeding games, the eight games that everyone's playing to finish out the regular season, were basically going to be glorified exhibitions. And that's not to discount how hard anybody's playing or the work they put in, but just the idea that after this long of a gap between games and guys being out of the gym, out of shape potentially, that it was just going to be a time to tune up. And plus, we've got all these teams that questionable whether they should be there in the first place, but the NBA needed more teams to have more TV games to make more money, which is fine. But I did, you know, teams have various levels of stakes and competitive drive at a time like this, because there's not as much at stake, obviously, for the Washington Wizards as there is for, you know, LeBron's Lakers. So I expected these games to be maybe a little bit messier. And I got to say, to the positive side, it's actually been pretty good. Like the games, as you said, competitive. And if defense isn't quite there yet, well, that's fine. Like from a viewer standpoint, the fan standpoint, like a lot of scoring is fine. As long as they're not just throwing the ball up into like the fifth row of non-fans, you know, it's fine. Like, I think the quality of play has actually been pretty good. And I would think arguably over the course of the next week or two, it'll get better by the time we get to the first round, and also eliminating some of, obviously, the bottom dwellers. I would guess it's going to be pretty close to what we would see in a normal mid to late April. Do you think?
I think so. Yeah. Look, I agree with you. I'll tell you the positive for me, and sort of based on what I expected, I thought the contending team, since there's no home court, I thought, especially early on in these games, you know, guys, their main guys would be playing limited minutes. I didn't think that they would care a lot about winning and losing right away, but that's not what I've seen at all. Those teams are competing. I mean, you know, Milwaukee, Toronto, Boston, you know, those teams are the contenders in the East. They're getting after it. Nobody more so than Toronto. Yeah. And then in the West, the Lakers and Clippers, clearly that game on the first night meant a lot to them, you know, but I've seen those contending teams. Houston is, you know, playing guys huge minutes and really going after it. That's been the most pleasant surprise to me. And looking at it now, I think what the coaches have figured out is, you know, these guys weren't ready to be pushed in practice to the limit, let's say, we're going to use the games to really ramp up our conditioning and our competitiveness. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I agree with you. The game for the viewers is great. The only thing, and I hope it'll cure up here quickly, the only negative to me in the games really is there's been so many fouls and a lot of them very undisciplined, a lot of foul and jump shooters and just what I would call bailout fouls, dumb fouls, and that slows the game down. And hopefully, again, these guys have had a huge layoff. And hopefully as they get back into it more, guys will be a little bit more disciplined and we won't be getting teams shooting 50 free throws in a game.
Yeah. But it kind of goes back to something you said earlier, right? Which is that if teams haven't had a chance to really work on defense as much, and or if conditioning is still a little bit of an issue, like aren't those the things that are going to lead to more fouls and more free throws because you're not quite getting to spots and now you're reaching a little bit, you're out of position, you're not in sync with each other, you're not on a string defensively, and so you're just going to have more of those defensive lapses, which then lead to late arrivals and fouls, right?
Absolutely right. Yeah, they're half a step late on things. And also, you know, as you alluded to, when you get tired, you just get a little bit sloppy in your technique and things like that. And you're trying to play hard, but you're tired. And so you grab a jersey or something like that. I think that's pretty natural.
Yeah. Has anything you've seen early on here? I mean, we've gotten to see all the contenders and the potential contenders all play a couple of times now. I think everybody's about two games in. Has anything you've seen changed anything that you thought on March 11th?
No, not really. Other than one thing, and it's not really based on what I've seen, though. I do see what I'm seeing on the floor, I think sort of validates my thought. I thought of the contending teams that the team that sort of got an advantage on the other teams here in the, layoff was the Clippers. And I think the reason is this, is obviously the Clippers' talent is among the best in the league, maybe the most complete roster in the league. The advantage that the other teams had on them, the Lakers, Milwaukee, Toronto, even though they had injuries, Boston, is they had continuity on them. I mean, going into this, bubble setup here, the Clippers had only played seven games with their starting perimeter together with Pat Beverly, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. And so, they were not very far along in building out what Doc Rivers wanted. And they were looking at March at a month until the playoffs started, whereas the Lakers had had their guys all year. Milwaukee had had a lot of continuity even from the year before. Same with Toronto, even though Kawhi wasn't there and they had some injuries. And Boston, even though they had to incorporate Kemba Walker, those guys played together with Team USA in the summer. So they had a lot of continuity. I thought that was the one disadvantage the Clippers had. Well, you take 4.5 months off, I don't care. There is no continuity now. Everybody's starting over in the middle of July with that first practice and moving on. And I thought that would help the Clippers a great deal. Now, the Clippers are still, it's been a frustrating year for Doc Rivers in the regard that every time he thinks he can get started building his team, we had his game, in Philly right before the All-Star break, and he was just looking forward to having practice time, because Marcus Morris and Reggie Jackson and, new people coming in and finally getting healthy. And then the pandemic hits. And so now he's on equal ground with everybody else, but now Lou Williams isn't here and Montrezl Harrell isn't here. And so if they can overcome that, though, nobody's got that big continuity that they had leading into the season. So I think that sort of changed for me and how I looked at the Clippers' chances going into the playoffs this year.
There's been two schools of thought on trying to kind of handicap the race for the championship, which is, I always say, like, you know, in the NBA, talent rules, and that's almost all consuming. That axiom above all else, talent rules. The best talented teams in March are still going to be the best talented teams going into the bubble, but then the bubble is presenting all these other weird things, right? The isolation and sequestering and no fans, and there's no home court, there's no road disadvantage, there's no any, like, all of the other stuff. And so you start to think, well, maybe that opens this up more, maybe it changes certain things, and like, we won't really know the answer to that one for at least a few weeks yet. But I've seen where, you know, David Thorpe recently wrote, he thinks there's seven contenders. And when I had Kenny Smith on a few weeks back, he said he listed nine contenders, which I think was a tad high. But if it's talent rules, then it feels like it's still just those three, the two LA teams and Milwaukee. Is there anything that you've seen so far or that you think you foresee because of this strange environment that you think might shake this thing up a little bit?
Well, look, I think the main thing, I mean, the biggest difference is no home court. And so that really evens up a lot of series because, you know, for me, and obviously doesn't always happen, but the odds are, I mean, we just got to look at history. If there's two teams that are pretty evenly matched, the team with home court is going to win most of the time. I mean, you know, that seventh game at home is tough to overcome. And so, you know, I would look, you know, like people all during the year would say Lakers, Clippers. And I say, well, Lakers are going to be at home. I'll take the Lakers in seven. Well, now you don't have any of that. And so even as we go in the earlier rounds, that edge that people have is not going to be there. You know, Toronto, Boston, round two, both really good teams. If it's in Toronto with home court, I'm taking Toronto. On neutral court, I have no idea. I mean, it just, and I think it's going to open up a lot of that. I mean, you know, Houston had put themselves in a position that they were probably going to have to win, you know, two rounds on the road to get to the finals. Well, now they don't. And that's a very potent offensive team. So, you know, could I see Houston beating, you know, the Lakers in round two? Yeah, I could. You know, I mean, I'm not saying I'd predict it, but if you had told me that we're in our normal playoff thing, I'd say no way are they going to win a seven-game series where they're going to have to win on the road, but they don't have to now. So I do think it's wide open. Look, I think there's five teams on top, the top three in the East and the two LA teams, but I think Denver and, you know, and Houston are both have enough there where they can beat anybody. I have a hard time seeing either one of them winning three series to get to the finals, but there's no series I would think was unwinnable for them. And I can see the same thing in the East with Miami or Philly, if Philly is at their best. I think Philly is maybe the most interesting team in the whole thing, Howard, because I don't know who they are. At home, they were unbelievably dominant. I mean, they just took apart some of the best teams in the league at home. I mean, the games weren't competitive. Yeah, they play Milwaukee and destroy them. You know, they play the Clippers right before the All-Star break and take them apart. You know, and you're going, oh my God, they're good. And then on the road, they're 10-24. And you're saying, they're the best home team by far. And they're the 20th best road team. Like, who are they? So how does that play out on a neutral court? We've seen one game here, and despite an unbelievable performance by Embiid, just they look very disjointed and didn't play well. But the talent is there. They're capable of playing at both ends of the floor. From a talent standpoint, you would think they should be up there with anybody in the East. So they're, to me, the most interesting team in this whole thing.
I could see that. Let's stick with the Sixers for a minute, because there's so many confounding things about them. On paper, you look at them and you say you've got two top 15 players, right? In a normal year, right? Like, Embiid won't make all NBA this year because he didn't play enough games. But in a normal year, two top 15-ish players. And that's a great foundation to be a contender. And then you look at the role guys and, hey, Tobias Harris, a good player. They've got decent pieces. Al Horford obviously is great. But chemistry has been weird with them. The fit with their two stars has been questioned. And now we've got, going into the bubble, all the talk of, well, now we're gonna move Ben Simmons to power forward, we're gonna play Shake Milton at point. Which of these things is most, I don't know, striking or pivotal to you? Like, if we're going to unlock the best version of the Sixers, and if they're going to do it in this very short amount of time, they need to get their stuff together. What will it, what do you think it would be? Like, what's the best version of them? And do you think that part of that solution is Simmons at the four nominally? Obviously he'll still have the ball in his hands a lot, but does that positional change matter?
Well, I think it matters. Like, everything matters. I think the number one thing for the Sixers, and Brett Brown talked about this way back before the season started. I think he's absolutely right. The way the Sixers are built, first and foremost, they need to be an elite defensive team. I mean, the one thing that they have that nobody else in the league can claim is that their two best players are legitimate first-team All-NBA type, All-NBA defense type of guys. I mean, nobody can say that about their top two players, you know, but they can. I personally would have Ben Simmons as my defensive player of the year. And Embiid, when he's at his best, is the best defensive big man in the league, I think. And so I think, number one, they have to be elite at that end. At home, they were. On the road, they weren't. Defense should travel. I mean, that's always been the axiom. Defense will travel. It didn't travel for them. And so I don't understand that. But they can't, to me, they can't just be good. They need to be elite defensively. Offensively, I liked what Brett Brown did, and he started it right before the All-Star break of trying to bring Al Horford off the bench. I think that made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I don't think everybody talked about the fit with Simmons and Embiid. I thought what was a little more uncomfortable was the Embiid Horford, you know, fit. And so I thought that was a good move. But what happened is right after he made that move, Ben Simmons got hurt and went down, and so now they had to put Horford back in the starting lineup, and they didn't get a chance to work on that. I think that Shake Milton into the lineup, to me, works because they get another perimeter player and a good three-point shooter, as is Horford, but even a more willing three-point shooter. And I think one of the things that I would like to see from the Sixers, which I've also heard Brett Brown talk about, is I think they got to let it fly a little bit more. So your two best players are guys that are going to do their best work on the interior. You know, Embiid can make a three, but I think you want him around the basket more. Simmons is at his best penetrating. If you're going to build around two guys who need room on the interior, those other three guys have to shoot threes without hesitation on the perimeter. And everybody talks they don't have enough shooting. Look, Shake Milton can shoot. Korkmaz can shoot. Tobias Harris can shoot. Josh Richardson's a pretty good three-point shooter. Glenn Robinson III can shoot. Alec Burton, they have enough shooting. They have a lot of guys, in my mind, that would rather put it on the floor and attack. And so a lot of times I see them, Ben Simmons or Embiid, draws help, kicks the ball out, and they want to bait the closeout and shot fake and put it on the floor and attack, and you keep bringing the defense back in. I think for their offense, they need to let, you know, have guys let it fly. When they, I'm not talking about forcing, I'm not talking about Damian Lillard level, you know, 35-foot pull-ups. I'm talking about when the ball comes out and you step into that shot, you know, let's step in and knock it down. And I think that would help them a great deal. They don't need, to me, to be a great, great, great offensive team. They just need to be above average offensively. You know, they need to be above the middle of the pack, and then their defense can carry them. So they've got to be a little bit better at both ends. But we've seen it. That's the one thing I like from their thing is, we can always look at teams and say, well, I think they could do better here, and I think they could do better there. And but we've never actually seen it. We've seen it a lot of times with Philly. We've seen it in their 29-2 home record. We've seen it several times where they've destroyed really good teams. We know it's there. Now it's a matter of doing it enough to win four games in a series enough times to get you to the finals.
All right, I know this is a big can of worms. It could be its own like 3-hour podcast, but let's cover this one real quick. If you were Ben Simmons's coach, would it drive you crazy that he won't take the open shots?
Not at all. I think actually it drives me crazy, quite honestly, when people focus so much on, they take a great player and they focus so much on one thing they don't do well, instead of the myriad of things that they do very well. Like, to me, Ben Simmons is a great player already. It's more about having shooting around him. I don't know at this point why you would want Ben Simmons shooting threes. It's a very, very low percentage shot for him at this point. I think he's smart enough to know that, and that's why he doesn't take it. He's at his best attacking. They've got other guys that shoot the three better. I don't know why people are fixated on that. But look, I've had a lot of big guys, and it's been the same thing. You know, I coach Shaq, and everybody fixated on his free throw shooting. Not the fact that nobody could guard him inside, and he was a great, great passer and everything else. And then I coached Dwight Howard, who was a defensive player of the year, and they focused on, you know, what they didn't think was a highly skilled post game and his free throw shooting. And then, you know, on to Andre Drummond. It's like, for some reason, shooting is the thing with people. Like, if guys struggle shooting, fans at least, they don't care what else a guy can do. Like, they want to see him shoot the ball. I mean, do you really want to watch Ben Simmons go 0-for-7 from three every night and somehow think that's going to help the team? You know what I would like Ben Simmons to do better? I love everything about him. To me, the must is he's got to shoot free throws better.
Yes.
Because I think what I saw last year in the playoffs is when it got late in close games, Ben Simmons didn't want to attack the basket because he didn't want to end up at the free throw line. I just want him to shoot free throws better. Everything else is great. Would I like him to improve his shooting as time goes on? Of course. But you don't bring into games, to me, what you can't do, especially this time of year. You bring into games your greatness, the things you are the best at. Ben Simmons, I think, knows that. I think, as good as he is, I think Ben Simmons is maybe the most underrated player in this league. I think the guy is absolutely terrific. He brings great energy every night. He's the only guy in the league that can legitimately guard positions 1 through 5. Mm-hmm. He is totally unselfish. He is unbelievable in transition with the ball. He is a great passer. He can score around the basket. Like, let's focus on those things and try to make free throws better, Ben. And let's go to work.
All fair. In defense of those of us in the media or the public, the fans who would focus on the shooting, I would just say this. Like, it's not so much that he's a bad shooter. There have been plenty of bad shooters. But even Rondo, who's not a shooter, when he's open, he's going to try to make the defense keep them honest by saying, oh, you're going to dare me to shoot? Fine, I'll throw one up now and then. And Giannis was not a shooter and probably still arguably isn't a shooter. But Giannis will occasionally, you know, hit 3-for-7 or something from 3-point range and is clearly not going to sit out there and just let teams play off of him. Now they're different players, but there's a similar makeup there in terms of the versatility of these two guys, big guys who handle the ball and everything. I do think there is at least a case to be made, not about whether or not he should be criticized for being a good shooter, but just being a willing shooter when the defense just leaves him out there open and is now sagging and mucking things up for his teammates. Is that not a fair premise?
Well, it's a fair premise, but I would just say this. So Giannis being a great example, you know, a good analogy for Ben Simmons, nobody plays him any differently. This idea that he keeps the defense honest. No, he doesn't. He makes a three occasionally. Sometimes, like you said, three in a game. He could make the first three in a game. The defense plays him no differently. They play him with a cushion. They back off, they stay in the gaps, and they do what they can to try to take away his penetration. Nobody is going to close out and try to take away Giannis's three, ever. Not at this point in his career. It's just not happening. I'll even talk, Howard, about a better shooter going back to when I was coaching. We would play against LeBron James, and, you know, he had years where he shot the ball very well from three. Like, we still didn't worry about the three with him. We were going to go under every pick and roll that we didn't switch on him. And we were going to cushion him with the ball. And if he made threes, he made threes. Because part of it comes down to this. Like, when you're talking the great players, you've got to you can't take away everything. You've got to take away something. I always looked at it like this. If LeBron is going to be making five threes, I'm talking about in his Cleveland days when we coached him, if he's going to be making five threes, well, you know what? We probably are going to have a hard time winning that game. But I know if we get out and try to take away the three and get up on him, that he's going to be in the paint all night. Yeah. He's going to be scoring, and he's going to be creating threes for better shooters than he is. So I was never thinking LeBron can't shoot. I was just thinking we've got to take away something. Like, you can't take it all. This is what I'd rather leave them with than LeBron creating and everything else. With Giannis, look, I haven't seen a team in the league who extends their defense onto Giannis. I haven't. You know, they're going to play off of him in the half court. And Milwaukee is, again, going to have to deal with that in the playoffs. And people say, well, that's why he's worked on his three. And that's great. And he may make some, and that may help them win. I can almost guarantee you nobody's going to play him any differently. You know, not shooting, what, 31% on a few makes? Like, no, that's – listen, if he's shooting the three, he's not getting anybody in foul trouble on your team. He's not around the basket to offensive rebound. Like, I'll make you a deal, Giannis. We'll give you that shot every single time down the floor. Take it. And that's how everybody plays him. So this idea of, I understand the premise, but the idea that it's going to keep teams honest, I haven't seen any evidence of that.
All right, fair. A couple more things before we get to, I can't let you go without us talking about Twitter and some political stuff in a minute, but a couple of quick basketball things first. You had the first game, which was, of course, Zion's re-debut, whatever it was, under a minutes restriction, the tough loss for them, all the ensuing controversy about minutes management, load management, all these things. It's been several days, but this story or this discussion probably won't go away, especially because New Orleans is looking like a team that some of us, I certainly thought, had a shot at chasing the eighth seed and is now looking like a pretty distant shot. What did you make of the way that the Pelicans handled that on the opening night of the restart? And how difficult of a position you think that was for Alvin Gentry, knowing that there was going to be a hard stop?
Oh, I think it's an incredibly difficult position for a coach. You know, coaching around minutes restrictions are very difficult, because what people don't understand, it's not just a matter of the fact that your best player or second best player, whatever you want to put it, is only on the court for 15 minutes. It's also that it messes up your rotation. You know, he's starting the game playing 3-4 minutes at the beginning of each quarter. You know, I mean, it's just a messed up rotation for how you want to play guys. So for a coach, it's really difficult. But I think the thing that none of us can fairly criticize is we don't know where Zion is conditioning-wise, health-wise, or everything else. I mean, they're medical people. Their front office, Alvin, those people all know what's going on. And as much as I'm sure they would love to make a push, maybe that's not realistic right now. He spent time away from them. He didn't even get the full 3-week ramp up here. I mean, it's really, really hard. And I'm sure it's frustrating to Zion Williamson, his teammates, to Alvin Gentry, to David Griffin, to everybody else, that they're not making more of a push. And to know, especially in that Utah game, that you lose a really close game and you've got a talent like Zion Williamson sitting over there watching the end of it, that's hard for everybody. But that doesn't mean that they made the wrong decision. I don't think that's fair based on – I don't have enough information to say they should have played him.
Yeah, I kind of take the long view on this, Stan, which is that they've got a kid who's obviously an otherworldly talent, and he came in with some physical concerns or health concerns when they first drafted him. He gets hurt early. He misses most of the season. You have to take the long view, I think, as an organization. Like, I would defend David Griffin and the rest of that team in general on this, that whatever your doctors told you, whatever advice you guys were being given, whatever restrictions were there, the idea of pushing past that and taking whatever risks, however small they may be, in this weird 8-game restart when Zion himself missed, as you mentioned, you know, he had to leave the bubble because of a family emergency. Like, this is not the context to be pushing a guy in. Like, if there's you want to break the minutes restriction in the middle of the conference finals because you feel like you've got, you know, a championship opportunity on the line, fine. Like, but in the first of 8 seeding games in a bubble as a potential 8th seed, that's still several games. Like, this is not the time to be pushing it with the kid this young, I feel like. And the backlash to me has been a little overwrought. Like, this kid's going to have hopefully a long and amazing career. This is not the time to be messing around. So, like, I totally support what they did. I think, you know, look, the Pelicans were a long shot anyway. If they don't make it and it's because they held Zion out on, you know, July, whatever that was, the 30th, I think I would be fine with that if it means that they're giving it that much more opportunity in the future.
Yeah, and they could have won the Utah game maybe, but second game they got absolutely crushed.
Yeah.
They could have played Zion 30 minutes in that game. I mean, they got crushed. I mean, yeah. And so look, I mean, everybody wanted to see him play 30 minutes. And probably the most frustrated guy anywhere was Zion Williamson. And he's basically said that. He's, you know, he's been loyal to his organization. He knows they're trying to do what's right, but he's a competitor. He wants to play. And when you're a competitor and you're sitting there watching the end of a close game, you don't care about what's best 5 years from now, not the competitor inside of you. You want to go out and help your teammates win that game. But again, I mean, you're right. The organization has to take the long view with his health. Like, I have said this, I've been very critical of load management, but to me, there's a big difference between load management, which is basically rest, 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 and injury management. Yeah. Those are two totally different things. If you're telling me that he's perfectly healthy and we're going to play him 15 minutes a night, you know, because we don't want to wear him out, I'm going to scoff at that. But when you have a guy his size coming off an injury and now had to be away, to me, that's injury management. And we lump those two things together, but they are, in my mind anyway, totally different.
Yeah. Speaking of that first night, opening night, restart opening, I don't even know what to call it. I couldn't help but notice, Stan, as I turn on the TV, there you and Ian Eagle are awkwardly separated by a glass partition in your sport coat and your button-up shirt while the coaches got the freedom to just wear polos. Of all the times for this to happen when you're not coaching and you're broadcasting and now you're, I don't know, did Turner force you to wear the sport coat? Could you have gone for the, like, if they're dressing down, could you have also, like, this just felt like they were taunting you in some way.
No, they were. And look, Howard, I would like to coach again. I would, but I enjoy what I'm doing now, but I've never wanted to coach as badly as I did seeing the coaches be able to coach in a polo shirt. That was it for me. Like, I was sitting there going, how the hell can I not be part of this moment down there? Some guys are even wearing sneakers. Some guys aren't even wearing polos. Brad Stevens is wearing a pullover. Like, this is coaching nirvana for me. And I don't get to be out there. But yes, they were nice enough. Look, I thought I hit the jackpot at Turner when they said we didn't have to wear a tie. I thought I hit the jackpot there. So I was still happy. But man, watching those coaches down there made me jealous. I got to be honest about that. And if you're asking me things, if you were asking me things that I think should continue from what we're doing in the bubble to what we do during the year, that's how coaches should dress. The fact that guys are out there sweating and up and down the sideline in coat and tie every night, makes absolutely no sense to me. This is the way it should stay.
Amen. As somebody who's sitting here doing my job at home in a t-shirt and a baseball cap, yeah, I'm with you. That felt really cruel and mean to be taunting you that way. Speaking of unfair things, you're still not verified on Twitter. By the way, fans, at RealStanVG, you're not verified. That seems not, you know, I don't know what Twitter's waiting for. We do know it's the real you, though, because you're holding up like the hostage photo with the little sign that says your Twitter handle.
Yeah, my Twitter. Yeah, it is me. And no, you know what? Both Turner tried to get me verified. And even before that, a consultant for one of the political campaigns that I've supported has tried to get me verified. And it's come back to both of them the same answer. Because of all the political demands leading into primaries and then the general election in 2020, that the only people at this time that Twitter is verifying are candidates and their highest level operatives. And so to go through the process of getting verified, I can't even do right now. When they first talked to me about it, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Getting verified. What do you mean verified? I mean, I didn't even know. But then they explained it to me. So I don't know if that's going to happen before November the 3rd because of everything that is going on.
I guess in Twitter's defense, they do have their hands full at a time like this, right? So if we could just get them to get all of the, like, you know, anti-vaxxer and dumb conspiracy theory about the coronavirus, get all that stuff. Like, I guess they should be spending all their time, like, getting the nonsense off of Twitter. And, like, eventually they can get around to verifying Stan Van Gundy, right? So there's time.
Yeah, eventually. I'm with you on that. Let's get the misinformation out there that sounds silly, but is actually dangerous.
Very much
so. Because you're always going to have people on there who, you know, will believe it. And so the anti-vaxxers have damaged a lot of people. And certainly some of these ridiculous theories on COVID-19 and what to take and all of that have cost people their lives. So, yeah, if Twitter's going to do anything, I should be about the lowest priority on their list. Let's get rid of. And listen, the political talk is one thing, but let's get rid of the misinformation that is dangerous to people.
No doubt. And more so by the day, it feels like. You were pretty outspoken, Stan, even when you were still coaching. I mean, certainly more so, I think, in your Detroit years than your Orlando years. But that's the whole league has kind of shifted, right? Like, even when we talk about Steve Kerr or Pop, or whatever, like, everybody in the last 4 years, for some obvious reasons, and I throw myself into this discussion too, because I used to be pretty politically tame in public areas, especially during my newspaper days. I have more freedom now. But many of us in the last 4 years have gotten to be very much more outspoken than we would have been in the past for obvious reasons. But you're out of coaching at the moment. You're using Twitter, the platform, for a variety of political causes that mean a lot to you. You're using your voice in a very, you know, demonstrative, emphatic way. And I've read a couple pieces where people have asked you about it. And you've said, like, no, this is what I feel like I need to do, which I get. But I think you're still probably looking at, you know, if there's another opportunity to come back into the league as a coach. And some of the I won't name names, but there are owners of teams in this league that clearly I don't think share some of the same political views that you and I do. I just wonder, do you ever concern? I know you're not concerned about fan backlash or Twitter backlash that you're not reading anyway because you're smarter than I am. But do you have any concern with how it might affect future job prospects, knowing that the political bent of a lot of NBA owners is not the same as yours?
You know what? I've never really given it a lot of thought. It may hurt me with some people. It may keep me out of coaching. But that, even if that's the case, that's not a good enough reason in the times we're in now, Howard, to sit silent. I don't think, you know, listen, I'm very fortunate to be in a financial situation where, you know, I don't need to work. I don't need to broadcast. I don't need to coach. And to just sit back and not say anything for selfish reasons to me would be sort of, you know, abdicating my responsibility. Like I do have at least a little bit of a platform. I do have some things that I want to say, and I hope it doesn't cost me future opportunities, but if it does, then so be it. I mean, if somebody would say to me right now, like, you know, I'll guarantee you another coaching job next year, but I don't want you speaking out about politics or issues from now until November. I'm not taking that deal. Like, I'm just not. I'm not at that point. And, you know, it's always been important, but now I just think it's, you know, with what I see going on in our country, I just can't. I wouldn't be able to live with myself sitting silent right now. There's too many things going on that in our country going in a direction that I think is really negative.
Yeah. No, amen. And I'm with you on all that. And it's kind of, it was the same thought process I had over the last 4 years as I started to use Twitter a lot differently, which was, I don't think I would be able to live with myself 5-10 years down the road or whatever. Like, well, during this time of all this madness, what did you do? You know, what did you say? How did you push back? And if I had this platform, even though the platform is because people want to follow me for NBA news and NBA hot takes or whatever they're looking for, like I if I alienate people, and I have, it's something I feel like it's same as you. I'm willing to live with that, because this is a time when I don't think any of us can afford to stay silent. So I admire, appreciate the fact that you and several others, especially obviously in this league and the NBA, better than most, or maybe better than all as leagues, that people feel empowered and encouraged to speak out. We're seeing that obviously 100-fold right now, every day, as the games unfold and everyone kneeling during the anthem, including referees and coaches, players, Black Lives Matter written on the court. You know, the people might cynically say it's just symbolism, but symbolism matters too. And I think everything that we've seen in these first, whatever, 5 days or so of the restart, I think all that's been moving and encouraging. I'm curious to see where it goes next. I don't think this will be the last of it. I think there will be more, both speech and action, but it's great. And as I say, great to always to pull up Twitter every day and see you as part of that conversation as well.
Yeah, thank you. And look, you're right. Symbolism is important. The words are important, but I don't want anybody to be fooled here. Like, the people in this league, I've been inspired by both the players and the coaches, because it's going far beyond the symbolism and the words. I mean, the coaches, I've never seen anything like it. They were nice enough to include me in some of their early calls. And, you know, they went out and had people coming in on Zoom calls and things. I mean, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative spoke to him. Rashad Robinson of Color of Change. The Obama Foundation spoke to him. I mean, they were educating themselves. And then they have all of those guys in all 30 cities have aligned themselves with grassroots groups in their cities, activists who are working on the issues of racial injustice and police brutality. I mean, they're out there attending meetings with public officials and, you know, no, these guys are involved. And I've seen players out, you know, were out at marches and leading marches before they got here, and people starting foundations. I mean, LeBron's voting initiative has been huge. I don't want to leave people out, but you can't hit all of them. Jrue Holiday giving up the $5.3 million he would make here or will make here in Orlando. He and his wife starting a foundation to support groups. So the symbolism is great. The protests are great. But what I'm most proud of the people in our league, the players and the coaches, is they're going beyond that and doing some real work on the ground to help the situation. And I know when the coaches group started, Howard, Lloyd Pierce was the guy in charge of the coaches for racial justice committee. And the very first thing Lloyd said is, we have to build something sustainable. And he has stayed on that. And I think the coaches are committed to building things that will outlast them in those cities. It's been inspiring for me to watch both players and coaches. And I think a lot of good is going to come of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's fantastic. Stan, this has been great. I think we went a little long, but I appreciate you sticking out. I know you've got plenty else to do. There's probably, like, I don't know, a cornhole tournament or something in the bubble there that you need to get to. And this is fantastic. I know you got a lot to do with that on the show, so I thank you for spending the time. We will definitely have to do it again before the bubble season is over.
Thanks, Howard.